His name is Frank Galvin. 4 cases in the last 3 years. He's lost them all. He drinks. This man's scared to death to go to court.
Frankie, listen to me, because I'm done with you. I got you a good case. It's a moneymaker.
The Archdiocese called up because the case is coming to trial.
This is our chance to get away.
I'm going to see that you get that chance. Court exists to give him a chance at justice.
And is that what you're going to do?
Maybe I can do something right.
It's a generous offer, Mr. Galvin.
I just heard someone offer you 200 grand.
When I walk out that door, the offer is withdrawn.
What are you, nuts?
I can win it. I can win this case.
But what are you going to do?
I need your help.
To do what?
They killed her. I'm trying to buy it.
I said, do you know what you did?
No, did.
Easy, take it easy.
Okay.
And I got to find out from the other side that they offered $200,000.
I can subpoena you, you know.
Well, maybe you just better do that then.
I had a witness disappear on me,
Your Honor.
You should have taken their offer. I have no sympathy for you.
We're going to lose.
Listen, the damn case doesn't start before tomorrow, and already it's over for you.
It is over.
I can't invest in failure, Frank, anymore.
Pushing into court 5 days early. I lose my star witness, and I can't get a continuance, and I don't care. I'm going up there, I'm going to try it, I'm going to let the jury decide.
All rise!
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having anything to do before the Honorable, the Justices of the Superior Court, now sitting in Boston, within and for the County of Suffolk, draw near, give your attendance, and you shall be heard.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining us once again is our pal, Omar Uden. Hi, Omar.
Hi, Rob. Hi, guys. How you doing? When I say guys, obviously I mean the audience at large. I know I'm just talking to you, Rob.
I have a bunch of people here in the audience as we're recording this podcast.
Okay.
We're here to talk about one of my favorite movies and one of Omar's favorite movies, Sidney Lumet's The Verdict from 1982, starring Paul Newman. This is one of, I would say, one of the great movies of all time, certainly one of the greatest legal thrillers ever made. And Omar, I want to start off by asking, like, when did you see this movie in the context of your personal legal career?
Well, so I had already seen it a couple of times growing up, but, you know, in the context of my career, where I sort of saw it for the first time with fresh eyes, you know, from the standpoint of my profession. I think it was about 2009. I'd been practicing for about 2 years, 3 years around that moment. And that was when, you know, the sort of the contours of trial work first started making an impression on me. And I was able to look at it from, you know, a bit of a more critical lens. That said, it still held up. You know, despite whatever dramatic liberties that are often taken within, like, you know, legal or medical frameworks on television and in the movies, I've always been a champion of the idea that, you know, it's about focusing on, like, the emotions and moods provoked as opposed to sort of getting the specific mechanical details right. So from that standpoint, it hit out of the park. But even, you know, even before I became a lawyer, this movie made an impression on me just sort of as a, you know, just as a character piece, but, you know, it definitely resonated 10 times more the first time I saw it in 2009. And then, you know, I've had my own practice, for about 7 years now. So as a practitioner, as someone freed from the constraints of a, you know, of a larger firm support structure, and as someone who kind of catches and kills and eats, you know, on an ad hoc basis, this kind of stuff does, you know, it did resonate extra with me.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, for anyone who hasn't seen the movie or hasn't seen it in a long time, Paul Newman plays Frank Galvin, and he's a down-on-his-luck alcoholic lawyer who accepts a medical malpractice case, and he does it basically to improve his own situation, but he discovers along the way that he is doing the right thing for the right reasons. Like I said, it stars Paul Newman, Charlotte Rampling, Jack Warden as Paul Newman's sort of friend, his old form from the law firm. James Mason plays the head of the rival law firm. Milo O'Shea plays Judge Hoyle, and boy, Milo O'Shea really swings for the fences in this one. Lindsay Krause plays a nurse with a sort of mysterious past. It's based on a book by an author named Barry Reese, and the adaptation is by David Mamet.
And you can tell.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is mammy all over the place. And what's really interesting about sort of the development of this movie is that, you know, Frank Gallen, right from the beginning, we know is an alcoholic. And this is a guy, we get a little bit of Frank's backstory, and we find out that he was once a real promising attorney. They mentioned that he was second in his class at his law school.
So at Boston College, which was a pretty solid law school.
There you go. Okay, yeah, right, Boston College. And he was a big star at this law firm. And then due to a colleague trying to tamper a jury case on Frank's behalf without Frank knowing about it, Frank basically got caught up in that and was thrown out. His wife left him, and his life just continued to spiral downwards till now. He's this kind of old, beat-up, alcoholic ambulance chaser. And the movie opens with him going to some funerals and shoving his business card in the hands of the widow and the widowers, and it's really a pathetic opening, and it's very startling to see Paul Newman, you know, the great Paul Newman, one of probably the most handsome people ever to walk the face of the earth, playing this kind of beaten down guy. And it was interesting is that the movie started as a project for Robert Redford, and Robert Redford apparently was interested in it, and then David Mamet got it and really played up the alcoholic angle, and Redford apparently was uncomfortable with that and didn't want to play that, and kept having Mamet rewrite it and downplay the alcoholic part of it. And then at some point, Redford just decided he wasn't interested in doing it. It got across to the desk of Sidney Lumet, and Sidney Lumet went back to the original version and said, no, I like this alcoholic angle. Brought it over to Paul Newman, and Paul Newman loved it, and off they went.
And so, you know, this to me is sort of a landmark movie for both Sidney Lumet and Paul Newman. And, you know, just from a larger context angle, I think Sidney Lumet is like one of the towering figures in Hollywood of like the post-war era. And, you know, when you look through his roster of movies.
Oh, it's unbelievable, the filmography he has.
You're talking about like a guy who made 12 Angry Men, I think by the time he was like, he was only like in his early 30s when he made that.
It's his first film.
The Pawnbroker and Failsafe and like Equus and like Murder on the Orient Express and like Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, for God's sake. Like, I mean, his filmography is staggering. And, you know, I would never have known who he was if I was just, you know, a casual film goer, because he never got the kind of ink or praise. I mean, it was funny, he was lumped in with sort of other New York centric filmmakers, and you know, I'm thinking of Woody Allen and Scorsese and Spike Lee, and he never got the kind of press or awards attention that they got. And I didn't become aware of Lumet until he was given like one of those honorary Oscars, like one of those Lifetime Achievement Awards in the early 2000s, and I was just like, who is this guy? And then when you go back and look at his body of work, it's unbelievable. And that he made this movie when he was in his mid to late 50s. And it's like a guy who's firing on all cylinders at the top of his game. You know, Lumet is often talked about as like the classic actor's director. And it really shines through here. And when you bring up the Redford to Newman, you know, hand up, of course it would make sense to have like Robert Redford like highlight any Hollywood movie from this era, because he could do no wrong. But I think, and I'm a big admirer of Robert Redford as a figure in film, as a filmmaker, and as an actor. I think he's actually somewhat underrated. But it is kind of telling that this matinee idol was so overly concerned with the idea of him just seeming so like so unkempt, so as a character. Disheveled and, you know, just the notion of him playing an alcoholic was anathema to him, to like, you know, America's leading man. And I think it's equally telling that it made its way to Newman's desk. I mean, Newman and Redford joined at the hip at this point because of Butch Cassidy and The Sting. But I also think it's equally telling that Paul Newman, who I personally would make an argument as like the greatest Hollywood actor of the post-war era, and this is including Marlon Brando, willingly, like, was just like, yes, I will absolutely take this role, even though he was no less handsome than Robert Redford, no less of a matinee idol than Robert Redford, yet he had this extra willingness to get his hands dirty, and then the notion of playing a character like Frank Galvin probably turned him on, and man, did he hit it out of the park.
I love the voice that Newman puts on. He's got this throaty, gravelly thing, and you really get the impression right from the first time you hear him talk that this is a guy who's been pouring back drinks his whole life, because he's kind of, and I'm doing a horrible version of it, obviously, but he's just got this, he doesn't sound like Paul Newman.
No, he doesn't. Yeah, I think this is the first role where, like, he was, to mainstream audiences, he was, like, flagrantly playing against type, at least the first time in a long time. But what he did with his voice, with his mannerisms, and what I love best about the performance in general, but especially in the beginning, was, you know, like those first like 15 minutes, I think it's within those first 15 minutes that you get a sense of how down on his luck he is. And you also see him kind of stumbling around the office. You know, there's that sequence where he's like kind of smashing his diploma smashing his diploma and, like, you know, ruining his file cabinets. And, you know, for a couple of seconds, I was worried the first time I saw it that it was going to kind of dissolve into a caricature of an alcoholic, what we imagine an alcoholic would be like. And they pull back from that point. And, like, for him to see, the key in his performance is the subtlety, is his facial expressions. Like, it's not about drawing attention to his condition. For me, the power in his performance are the quiet moments.
Right. I mean, he's a functioning alcoholic.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, he is not one of these, as you say, like, fall-down drunks that, you know, clearly needs to be, you know, given, put away and kind of forcibly, you know, made to not drink anymore. This is a guy who can function. I mean, he can, but he's also has ruined his life. I mean, you see, he's constantly having to cover for how shabby his practice is. He talks about, you know, oh, you, the, when the, his client, Roxanne Hart, the sister of the woman who's been wronged by this hospital, is waiting for him, and she can't get in. He pretends that, oh, where my secretary must have gone out. And we know there's no secretary.
There's no secretary.
There's no secretary. This is all. He just went out for a drink, and he didn't think that the client would be there waiting for him, and so he has to cover. And the place is really run down. I mean, one of the things that I love that Lumet does in this movie, and it's right from the opening shot of Frank Galvin playing a pinball game. I think it's a Saturday Night Fever pinball game, which is very funny to me. I love the opening shot over the credits, and because it's Newman's character draped in darkness, and you see the window behind them and the snow falling, and it looks kind of like The Godfather when you first see it. It has that same tone to it, and on the cinematography front, I thought maybe this was Gordon Willis who shot The Godfather movies, because it has that look, but it's not. It's a guy named Andre Bartowiak. I hope I'm saying that right. This was a guy, very renowned cinematographer. He did 9 other films with Lumet. So this was a guy that clearly they worked together really well. And I love the colors of this movie. It looks like it's got all autumnal colors. It's all browns and kind of grays and darks. There's no primary colors in this movie at all.
Which it adds to, like, kind of the grim feeling throughout.
Right. It's you. This is a guy whose career is winding down, and maybe even his life is winding down, and it has that feeling to it. And I just love that mood that Lumet and his cinematographer puts across, because you just – everything's worn. Everything's just sort of beaten down. And, of course, Jack Warden playing Frank's old friend. I mean, even just every line that that Jack Warden says has a beaten down kind of just, what are you going to do kind of –
Well, and I think beginning with when he finds Frank passed out, and he basically tells him off, saying, you know what, like, I'm kind of done helping you. You have an opportunity with these clients that I brought in for, like, a nice, handsome settlement. Don't screw this up. And, like, he says this, he gives this line of, like, you're not going to change. You know, like, he kind of takes measure of this guy, looks around this office, you know, like, reminds him of a court date that's rapidly coming up that he's obviously made no attempt to prepare for. And, you know, he just those words, like, you're not going to change. And what you were saying about, you know, the way they kind of selected with care the surroundings, this is true of the office, which is, you know, kind of shabby enough, but it extends to, like, his sad little one bedroom apartment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. When he there's later on, I mean, we're jumping around a little bit. Later on, he meets Charlotte Rampling, plays a woman that he meets at a bar, And it's sort of funny how confident, even this shabby Paul Newman is confident, because he walks into the bar and he sees her and he hits on her and she rejects him. And then when he sees her again, he's in the bar with Jack Warden and he's like, can we do this later? And Warden's like, what do you got to do? He's like, I'm going to go get laid. And he's like, okay. And so they go back to his place and it's real shabby. And we see the picture of presumably his ex-wife on the mantle, not at the mantle, on the bedstand. And he looks a little embarrassed at that. And he flips the picture down so the picture can't, quote-unquote, see what they're about to do. And Charlotte Rampling's character is like, it's okay. And she starts unbuttoning her blouse.
The best part about that, I mean, it's like the look he gives upon, like, seeing the picture and the way he kind of, like, shambles over there and then doesn't just put the thing down, like, face down, which is funny enough, but he gives, like, this half shrug to her, which just kills me. You know, yeah. That is like a pure pathetic slash confidence move that I can only respect.
Right. The case that he's handed is this woman went to a hospital and she ended up dying because she aspirated, as they say, in her mask. But she vomited in her mask. And the whole crux of the case is that they asked her, when did you last eat? And supposedly she said, I ate 9 hours ago. And they're like, well, that's all right then. Or 1 hour ago. And so she aspirated her mask and she died on the table. Not died on the table. She had lost oxygen to her brain and it turned her into essentially a vegetable. And the reason Galvin thinks he's got a slam dunk case is after Jack Warren gives it to him is that he goes to visit the head of anesthesiology at this hospital. It's a guy named Dr. Gruber, and this guy, his name is, the actors play Lewis Stadlin, and he lays the case out for Paul Newman very well and says, look, these doctors killed her. They absolutely killed her. They gave her the wrong medicine. They were unattended about how long she was deprived of oxygen, and I don't want these clowns in my hospital anymore. And Frank Galvin's like, you're going to testify? He goes, absolutely, I'm going to testify. And so after he drives away, and when he says to the guy, you know, why are you doing this? And he says, because it's the right thing. Isn't that why you're doing it? And Galvin does a little jig in the parking lot because this is just such an easy slam dunk.
How gleeful and childlike was that jig? It was so great.
Oh, my God. It's pretty offensive because you realize why he's – but at the same time, it's like he's just so happy that he's got an easy case.
Well, in the context of that – correct me if I'm wrong. The context of that meeting was because his whole mindset from the moment Jack Warden handed off the case and told him to shape up was, hey, this is a quick hit. This is an easy settlement. As long as you don't screw this up, you know, you'll be able to make a good amount of money to set your, you know, to set you up for a little while. Rapidly self-destructing. So I think he goes to see Gruber. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. He goes to see Gruber in the context of, oh, of course I would, you know, of course I would settle this. And Gruber's just like, of course, what are you talking about? Of course you fight back. What these people did, I don't want to be tainted by association with these physicians.
Right, right. Because the whole idea is that this is a Catholic hospital. So, I mean, it's got the Catholic Church of Boston, which is, you know, the most powerful entity there is. They've got the deep pockets. They don't want to go to trial. So the whole thing is, it's basically like, hey, Frank, just get a settlement out of court. You'll get a ton of money and it'll be fine. But the problem is Frank then goes to visit this young girl at the hospital.
Ah, his damn conscience. His conscience struck. Right. You know, he could have gone in and made a quick hit. And like walked away, and everyone, you know, and we wouldn't have had, you know, the misery unnecessarily prolonged and this tension. But he like you're right. He goes and sees her, and like it's that moment where he takes those two Polaroids of her, and you know, and he's watching them develop, and you just see on his face like what is happening, like what he's become.
The scene where he goes to visit her is really an amazing sequence because she's curled up in the fetal position.
Yeah.
And he's taking pictures of her with his Polaroid and he's kind of just doing it very pro forma, just ka-chung, ka-chung. But then at one point he turns and he's facing her.
Yeah.
And he sees something and he takes the pictures and he puts the pictures on the bed and Lumet just holds on the Polaroids.
Yep.
As they develop.
As they're developing.
Yeah, and we see these pictures literally come into focus of this person. And he, in this moment, Galvin realizes this is a person. This is a person whose life has been utterly destroyed by the mishandling of these doctors, and he can't just treat this like it's a slam dunk anymore. And then
it seemingly snaps him out of his stupor. Like, you know, for me, that, I mean, that moment was powerful enough. What highlighted it too was you're kind of broken from that moment as he's focusing on the Polaroids. You're broken out of it for a minute by the sound of like the nurses laughing, carrying on another conversation before they see him and say, "Hey, you can't be in here." You know, because they're just kind of going on with their lives, and he could easily do the same by taking the settlement. And he has this just the look on his face. It's like simultaneously snapping him out of his cesspool and into attention, and like it kind of jump starts him into action. But it's also devastating because he's taking into account the human cost of all of this.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, when the nurses say, "Hey, you can't be in here. Hey, you can't be in here." And he's sitting on this bed and he's not listening. And finally, I think that one of them comes in and kind of grabs him. And he just says, "I'm her lawyer."
Yeah.
And he says it in this very powerful way. And, you know, it's easy to make fun of lawyers. I'm sure you've.
You don't say.
With, you know. Yeah, you don't say. I'm sure this is news to you, Omar. But it's a very powerful moment in that it's Frank saying, "I'm this woman's representative. This woman can't defend herself anymore, and I'm the one that has to do it." And he gains purpose.
Yeah.
I'm her advocate, and he gains in that. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where there's this thing about being a movie star that is able, you're able to convey something that other people cannot do. And Newman conveys in that moment, everything is hindered. The soul of Frank Galvin is hanging on this moment that he is taking this seriously.
Yep.
And it's amazing.
The pathetic nature meets this like moment of gravitas, and like you are in it from that point. Like you buy him as her representative to, like, you know, the court of law, her representative to the world at large. It's this sobering moment. And I think, you know, chronologically, I it's important to kind of put this into a little bit of context. I think one of the next moments is, and you know, the next sequence of the film is the kind of game of chicken that they're playing with the archdiocese law firm with regard to the settlement issue. And you know, what I found really interesting, Rob, was the contrast that Lumet and Mamet draw between, you know, the archdiocese law firm and, you know, the kind of professional way they go about it, and the way they, you know, do their due diligence on Frank Galvin, you know, reciting his resume, like noting where he ended up, why he got kicked out of his law practice, married, divorced, whatever, and contrasting with, you know, kind of the stumbling initial efforts of Frank to put a case together. And so, like, you immediately get the feel, once, you know, that moment in the hospital when he's sort of grasping the importance of what he's taking on, "I'm her lawyer," and you immediately shift to this focus on what exactly he's up against. And having tried a number of personal injury matters, like, I can tell you this is exactly what happens. These larger law firms, these larger practices that represent, you know, corporate entities or larger organizations, they take stock of who they're dealing with, because their initial assumption, if they're dealing with, you know, someone who has a smaller time reputation, their immediate assumption is this person is probably just out to do a quick hit settlement, has neither the time nor the resources nor the stomach to actually take something to trial. And so we are going to, like, test that theory and lead hard on that theory, because we imagine if we dangle a small modicum of money, then they're going to crack because he's small time.
Right. I mean, they establish – he mentions when he's talking to the sister and her husband of his client, and he talks about that, "I get a third. I'm going to get it. That's the industry standard. I get nothing if we lose, but if we win, I get a third." And then when he goes to see the church, and the cardinal is played by, I have to mention, Edward Binns, one of my all-time favorite character actors, one of the 12 Angry Men, along with Jack Warden. So we've got two, we've got jurors numbers 6 and 7 here. They don't have any scenes together, but it's great to see them in another Sidney Lumet film.
Yeah.
But when he talks to Paul Newman, he hands Paul Newman the check, and the check is for $210,000. And Galvin mentions, and he notices how neatly that divides into three.
Yep.
And and I love that they kind of rub salt in the wound a little. As you said, they are so certain that he's just this ambulance chaser who will take the quick buck, that if they literally give him an extra 10 just so he doesn't have to do the math, he'll fold. and then almost insults him further, you know, and he mentions to them, I can't help but notice that that number divides very evenly into thirds. And Edward Binns's character's like, well, that's what our insurance company said we should offer you. And he kind of just plays dumb a little. But I love that they think that that's going to buy him off, and that just spurs him on further.
Well, and yeah, and you know what, in a sane world, it would. And what's funny about it is, I don't need to tell you that, like, $210,000 in any context is a lot of money. $210,000 in, like, the late 70s, early 80s is a phenomenal amount of money. And it would set him up for the rest of his life, most likely. And even given the best position of cases, he would be insane not to seriously consider it. You know, we could have a separate portion of this podcast devoted to, you know, sort of the minute technical legal, like, deficiencies in how they portray, like, legal procedure in this case. And, you know, obviously one of them is that he, you know, makes the decision to either accept or reject the settlement in that office without consulting his client, which is, like, immediately sanctionable conduct. For the purposes of, you know, the dramatic propulsive storytelling in the film, it was a like, stomach-tightening, you know, silently cheering moment for this formerly down-on-his-luck man who's going to, like, take a shot at redemption. But the lawyer in me was cringing, as he would a couple other times during the course of this film, when actual legal protocol was broken. Like, yeah, you definitely take that offer to your clients. And, you know, they were justifiably upset when they found out what he had turned down.
Right, at least they have that scene where he gets confronted in the rotunda by the brother-in-law, and he's like, you know, what the hell are you doing, you know? Yeah. And he's like, you just care about your combat money. And, of course, Galvin is trying to convince them, no, this case is way bigger than $210,000. This is just a tiny crumb of what you could get. But they don't want to hear that, you know? I mean, they want to take the money and disappear. They want to move away. They're going to hand the care of their sister and sister-in-law over to this hospital. They're going to take the money and leave town. And here's Galvin. Here's their own lawyer getting in the way of that. And he even decks Paul Newman, which is really funny. I mean, you're like,
really fun.
But I mean, that's I'm glad you mentioned the scenes in the law firm, because all of those scenes with James Mason. And, of course, you've got James Mason with that wonderful speaking voice that he's got, where he can say the most evil things, but it sounds somewhat reasonable.
Yeah.
I mean, they're in these oak-paneled offices with 1,000 law books.
I mean, that's the thing, Rob. It's like, I mean, my first instinct is to be like, well, they land on that contrast between that and Frank's shabby operation a little thick. But they really don't. I mean, yes, James Mason patrician accent is to me, it hit a little bit over the top. I was like, all right, guys, I get it. He's in his bow tie. He's in his nightly, you know, nicely lined mahogany offices, whatever. You don't need to add the, you know, the old money accent. But, like, the thing is, it tracks. It tracks with how this works. What makes the contrast effective, not just those flourishes, but also, like, the army of young associates and mid-level partners who are tasked with trying this. The people that, like, do their diligence on who the plaintiff's attorney is, what his story is, who are the operating witnesses, what are the relevant deadlines. Like, there is a methodical organizational quality to how these large firms handle things. And because, you know, as much as their clients initially wanted to settle, once the decision is made that this is going, I mean, like, nothing is spared. No expense is spared by these larger organizations. They come at it with, you know, they're out for blood from that point on. And I thought that the contrasting of that initial scene when they were talking about dates and deadlines and, you know, divvying up responsibilities for, like, associates and everything. And then you immediately jump, I think, to, like, Frank and the Jack Warden character, like, in the law library, just kind of bumbling through case law, was very effective.
Yeah. I mean, the first scene with James Mason talking to all of his younger charges, and he's got like 20 people on his case. I mean, it reminded me of the scene in the opening scene at the Death Star in Star Wars, like all these evil people, because they're so kind of smug about it. They're all just like, you know, like they're really, and I love how Ben, James Mason.
No, Ben Kingsley is the man who unjustly beat Paul Newman for the Oscar that year.
That's in my notes. That's why I said we're going to get to that too. Yeah. The way James Mason's character sort of convinces himself that he's doing the right thing, because there's a scene later on where he talks about his mentor, and his mentor says, how did you do? And he says, well, I did my best. And he says, we're not paying you to do your best. We're paying you to win the case. And he says, I know we do this kind of work and it's a little unseemly, but that's how we're able to do so much pro bono work for the poor. And the way they convince themselves that, this evil is okay because we do a lot of other good work.
And it's not, and again, this is one of those things, Rob, where it's not really that far off from how these larger firms kind of justify what they do. And again, it sounds self-serving because I definitely am on the Paul Newman side of like the practice scale. So, I go up against these guys all the time, and there is a sort of quiet condescension / legitimate confidence that they have. And it starts out as a confidence about like their resources and their ability to sort of, sit on things and to manipulate juries. And it starts out as a confidence of pure lawyering, but it eventually bleeds into a larger statement on what they do and how it actually is just, and how kind of people in my line of work are necessary annoyances that have to be dealt with. And so that part really rings true. I mean, I wish I could say it was some type of like mustache twirling villainy that was, highly specific to film. It's not. It's reflective of the dynamic between attorneys in this context.
Speaking of mustache twirling, eyebrow twirling, really, because Galvin and James Mason sit down and they meet with the judge, played by Milo O'Shea, the great character actor.
Wonderful actor.
Milo O'Shea, in case you don't know the name, you've seen this guy. This is a guy with the greatest eyebrows in the history of cinema. And he plays the judge. And he says, come on, you don't want to take this to court and waste the people's time. Can't you just settle this? And Galvin is like, no, I want to try this. And Milo O'Shea pretty clearly is corrupt, is utterly corrupt.
Yeah.
And he has it out for Galvin. And Galvin is like, no, I want to try this case. And Milo O'Shea's kind of like, all right, I think this is a mistake, but we'll try the case. Because, of course, Galvin thinks he's got a slam dunk. And then his star witness, Dr. Gruber, disappears.
Can I just interject? Like, in that meeting with Milo O'Shea's character and the opposing counsel, one of the great exchanges from this movie, when Milo O'Shea was kind of leaning on Frank to kind of to settle, just revisit the idea of settling, because, the defense attorney did indicate that, hey, we're going to leave this offer open again, just today, but if I walk out that door, Frank has a chance to actually like redeem everything and settle and clean up his mistake by rashly deciding not to settle. He has another opportunity to kind of reset the table. And what killed me was that exchange where Milo O'Shea walks up to Frank and he says, hey, what would it take for your client to walk out of here and let this whole matter drop? And Newman just kind of looks at him and is just like, my client can't walk, Your Honor. And it's this gruff, abrupt, matter-of-fact delivery that, like, to me is like, from Paul Newman, is like a stone cold classic.
Yeah, he really sticks the knife in Milo O'Shea at that moment, because he's like, this is serious. I'm here to play.
Yeah,
and so then, when he realizes his star witness, Dr. Gruber, disappears, and this is something that I really love about this movie. And I don't know whether this was Mamet or this was Lumet or there were both of them or whatever. But Gruber disappears, but it's not in a kind of John Grisham-y, we see a group of guys drag him out of his house. He's just gone.
Yeah.
He goes on vacation and his
– Who among us wouldn't go on a beach vacation a couple days before they have to testify for a trial?
Right. But I love that they leave that unsettled. Because, of course, and again, I'm not trying to knock John Grisham movies, because John Grisham movies are fun too.
Yeah.
But this is not that movie. I mean, you could very easily see a scene like this in The Firm, where Tom Cruise is his number one witness disappears, and then Tom Cruise has to like run down a rainy street because there's a car that pulls out, and who knows what's going on. There's none of that. It's just the guy's just gone. And all of a sudden, Newman's case is pulled out from under him.
It's incredibly fragile. And you know what I like about that decision, that you highlight the contrast between the way a standard legal thriller would work, is that, you know, Mamet and Lumet are smart enough to let us kind of fill in the shade on our own, color in on our own to decide what happened. And it's not explicit like you say, but I do like the suggestion of like, well, of course he wouldn't end up testifying because we're us and they're them. So the notion that like, well, they got to this guy is totally reasonable. But I think they make the superior choice in like not exploring that further and not poking at it and letting the audience just kind of assume, oh my God, it's the Archdiocese of Boston and their attorneys are some of the most powerful, you know, attorneys in the country, if not the world. Of course, this guy wouldn't end up testifying. The specifics are probably less important. And you know, this goes to the strength of David Mamet and people like him and Paddy Chayefsky and like Aaron Sorkin, who are dialogue heavy, and this is true of Mamet, dialogue heavy, but in the important moments, still steps back and lets the audience draw their own conclusion. He still follows the cardinal storytelling rule of show, don't tell, while still talking a lot.
Yeah, yeah. It's a marvelous scene of understatement, because it's like he is like the doctor's it's like his service is like, well, he went to – and it, like he didn't just go on vacation. He's like in like the Caribbean, like somewhere really far away where they're like, oh, okay. And then, of course, now Frank Galvin has no case, and he's so pathetic that he calls the law firm and basically he says, we're going to take that offer now because my client – and he pretends that his clients have changed their mind, but the offer has been rescinded. He then does the really desperate move of going to the judge's house and basically says, can I get an extension? And Milo O'Shea's character, Judge Hoyle, literally says, I have no sympathy for you. We're going to trial. Basically, which means you're going to lose, but I don't care. And shuts the door in his face.
As he shuts the door in Newman's face, Kay Corleone style.
It's fantastic. I love how slowly he shuts it. Like, I have no sympathy for you, as the door just slowly, and you're like, poor Frank Galvin is just screwed. He's just utterly screwed. And then he goes, and there's, I can wonder, and this is one of the things I think this movie is beyond just a great legal thriller, I think, and is in the realm of just a great movie, is because he then turns to his erstwhile girlfriend, who's Laura, played by Charlotte Rampling, and he turns to her and he's sort of like, the case is over. This kid, I've lost. And she is like, what are you talking about? The case hasn't even, the trial hasn't even started yet. And he's like, but it's over. And she sort of says something like, look, I'm not your mommy. It's like, you're like a little kid that doesn't want to go to school the next day.
I'm not going to write you a note to saying you're sick.
Yeah, she absolutely refuses to buy into his bullshit, and there's this great moment where he, I think, starts like almost hyperventilating.
Oh, he's having a panic attack, no doubt.
And he goes into the bathroom and shuts the door, and he's like, and she tries to get in. He's like, no. And you feel like it's like he's probably maybe got even the shakes a little because he's probably trying not to drink as much.
Yeah,
again, as much as the legal stuff is great, this is such a wonderful character moment. This is a guy who wants someone to kind of tell him, yeah, Frank, you're a screw up. You screwed up. It's okay. But she won't give him that out. She's like, no, it's not okay. You have to go and do this anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, it's – and we can talk about the Charlotte Rampling subplot a little more later if you want. But I this is one of those scenes where at first glance – because by that point in the movie, the first time out I had seen it – it's just kind of like, well, okay, I guess this is the standard, you know, girl subplot in these types of movies. Don't know how necessary it is, but whatever. I guess that's what we do back then. But that scene, you know, even before learning about her larger role in all of this, that scene really turned me around, even, you know, watching this as a kid, because it was just like, no, there's something more to this. This is not sort of a docile partner that's just there to kind of rub your back and tell you everything's going to be okay. She challenges him in a terse, cutting, but ultimately intelligent way that doesn't, you know, that is not indulging him at all, and kind of forces him to be like, no, I'm not going to just kind of embrace the idea that this is who you are, it's okay because this is who you are and you're a failure and you're, you know, a screw up. It's just like, no, you're not going to call the match before it started. Go do something about it. And again, his scene in the bathroom when he's freaking out, like so many scenes in this movie, could have been so much more over the top. But because Lumet knows how to direct actors, and because Newman is a masterful actor, it never seems that way. It's all interior.
Yeah, it's truly an amazing, amazing performance. It's funny you say that Charlotte Rampling's character isn't there to rub his back and tell him everything's okay. That's actually Jack Warden's role.
Jack Warden's job.
There's literally a scene where his character Mickey is giving Paul Newman a back rub and basically saying, you screwed up, it's okay, there'll be other cases. And that leads to this amazing sequence, another amazing – this movie's full of amazing sequences – of Paul Newman with his head down and he's got the cigarette and he's saying, there is no other case. This is the case. There is no other case. And he's saying it like a mantra because he realizes deep, deep down, this is it. If he doesn't get this one right, he's over. He's yep. over in so many different ways. And so he goes to trial. All he has is this one witness who's a doctor who is sort of a professional testifier.
And black.
Yeah, and black, right. They even comment, James Mason talked about it, and he's black. You're like, oh, Lord. But he talks about this is a guy who is on the board of, like, anesthesiologists, but he's not, you know, he didn't investigate. He's one of these guys that you can sort of pay to show up and testify and kind of say what you want him to say.
And the big firm knew that because the big firm did their due diligence on him, and they recited his, you know, semi-crappy resume with the same cheerful disdain that they did when searching out Paul Newman's character.
Right. And unfortunately, this guy's testimony is pretty much detonated by the judge.
Yeah, speaking of things that, like, don't track with how things actually work, what the judge did was immediately, like, disbarrable conduct. Like,
right.
Jumping in and taking over the testimony, taking over the line of questioning from Paul Newman, and basically essentially saying, I'm going to direct the inquiry into this to this witness and guiding it in the direction that he wanted to achieve the outcome he did. I mean, that is like, I mean, it's a great dramatic moment, right? It is like, it's shocking. It's like, it kind of boils, you know, your blood boils when watching it because it's like, oh, this guy is absolutely corrupt, absolutely in the pocket of no doubt his golfing buddy, the partner, senior partner at the defense firm. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, that goes in the list of conduct that would like, get a judge immediately disbarred. I definitely made a note of that.
Right, because he basically gets this witness to say, they cut her oxygen off for 2 hours, but that isn't necessarily negligent. And he pretty much just destroys the case. And Galvin even has a line saying, Judge, if you're going to try my case for me, I would appreciate it if you didn't lose it.
Yeah.
And he just knows that's it. That's the end of the case. But Newman keeps digging, and the other sort of thread that he follows is there's a nurse who was at the hospital who isn't around anymore, and she doesn't live in the city, and no one seems to be able to get to her. And that's where you're like, well, wait a minute, what's going on there? And he continues his thread, and there's another amazing scene with a nurse played by Julie Bavasso, who is mostly a stage actress. And I listen, if you have The Verdict on DVD or Blu-ray, it comes with a commentary by Lumet, and Lumet talks about casting this scene because basically she's only in this movie for three scenes. There's one big scene where Newman corners her because she won't testify. She was there too, but she won't testify. And he's like, well, why aren't you testifying for the other side if they didn't do anything wrong? He knows there's something up. And Lumet talks about that if you're going to get somebody who is going to go toe-to-toe with a movie star of Paul Newman's magnitude, you got to get just a really good actor. And he gets this woman that he knew, Julie Bavasso, and she just brings it and stuffs it back in Paul Newman's face because he keeps trying to threaten her. He's like, I'll subpoena your ass and I'll get you. And she's like, you go and do that. And she shuts the door in his face, and you totally buy that she is not intimidated by this guy. And that's got to be hard when you're kind of an actor that nobody knows and you're in a one-on-one with Paul friggin' Newman.
And she, you know, she was wonderful, and her eyes were like big and expressive.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Lumet had this skill of drawing out extremely memorable performances from actors with not a lot of screen time. I'm reminded of, Beatrice Straight winning an Oscar for like basically 10 minutes of work in Network.
Yep.
This nurse made such an impression and kind of set the dominoes falling of Frank kind of thinking, what else is going on here? And she was so forceful, and she shoved it right back in his face when she slammed the door in him and said, you know, you guys are all alike. It was unbelievable. And that's a follow-up scene when where he finds her in the hospital chapel. And, you know, he kind of discerns that this other nurse is in New York. And again, her expressive eyes just kind of give her away. She's a fantastic actor.
Yeah, Frank is actually a pretty good detective. As lawyers go, he's really good at enabling people to give him information that he needs, and they offer it without them knowing they're offering it, because he talks about this other nurse, Caitlin Costello, and he talks to Jolie Bavasso's character, Maureen, and he says, oh, I just saw Caitlin. And she goes, you saw Caitlin today? And he's like, yeah, I just saw her. And he goes, she's here? She's in, you know, not in New York? She's not here, she's not in New York? And he immediately is realizing, oh, okay, that's where she is.
And he immediately leaves with us, you know, which is great. He just, like, gets up and goes.
Yeah, he's got the information that he needs from her, and then he takes off. And so while that is going on, there's this other subplot that we do need to talk about, which involves, again, Charlotte Rampling, where we find out that Charlotte Rampling is on the payroll of the opposite law firm. And because there's this long scene with James Mason, and that's the scene where he talks about when he was a young lawyer and, you know, I did my best. And he's pouring this drink and he talks about all the good work that the law firm does and all the pro bono work we do for the poor. Ah. And he hands the drink to Charlotte Rampling.
It pays for my whiskey. Didn't he say this money pays for my whiskey?
Pays for my whiskey, yeah. And he hands it the drink, and we find out that she is on the take. And I've never been able to figure out, and it doesn't really matter whether is it – was she sort of a plant from the beginning, or do you think that – they once – like the law firm's been watching Frank so closely that the minute they see that these two are hanging out, they go and they get to her afterwards.
Well, what I mean, the subsequent conflicted looks on her face made me feel like they got to her after she met Frank. Like she might have met Frank organically. On the other hand, like she did indicate that, like, you know, her ex was an attorney, and so maybe she had like a pre-existing relationship. I don't know about that. But, you know, the two observations I would make about – well, I would make three observations about sort of her, the unfolding of her character. One is, you know, kind of go back to the idea that, you know, at first glance, this is a very thin gruel for this character when you first get to meet her. And, you know, especially as, you know, we've gotten fortunately more cognizant of the role that women have played in films up to now, which is, to charitably put it, sparse and insulting. At first glance, it's just kind of like, what are you doing with this character? Like, he doesn't need a love interest to kind of, like, flesh it out. I get it. It's 1981, 82 when they're making this movie, and that's just kind of what you do, even though it's, like, kind of shameful and inexcusable. But, I kind of take the position that if that was what she was just going to be, just some window dressing to flesh out the three-dimensionality of his character, it's like, I don't know that we need that. I don't know that she brought anything. But the things that turned me around on her, you know, the first time I saw the movie were, one, that scene when she kind of calls him on his crap and is like, no, I'm not going to kind of let you slither out of this by saying you're a screw-up, Frank, it's fine. And the other aspect was that she was on the take the whole time. So it does add a dimensionality to her character, and she does kind of play the conflicted notion of it okay. I mean, I would be more comfortable if it was not this sort of, you know, two-dimensional villain role. I think Charlotte Rampling is a good enough actor that she makes a lot out of it. Yes. And it does lead to that highly uncomfortable moment where he walks up to her in the hotel bar in New York and punches her, which we talk about. But you know what? The other aspect of that that I really loved was the scene where Jack Warden flies to New York after he discovers her duplicitousness. He flies to New York to talk to Frank about it. And what I love about how Lumet handled that moment in Mammoth.
Oh, it's an amazing way to do it. Amazing way to stage it.
Oh, yeah. No dialogue. You just see the exterior shots of, like, them walking and talking about it. And you see, and again, for me, the strength with Newman are his, like, his nonverbal reactions to things. And the way he just kind of stops and takes a step back as Warden is gesturing and talking, it's masterful. That is Mammoth and Lumet showing, not telling.
Yeah, they're just these tiny. It's like a bird's eye view shot of just these guys on the street, and you could barely tell that it's them. I mean, you mean arguably they could have not even been Newman and Warden, except for the fact that they're such great actors and they were able to convey so much, just even though you're a mile up from them. But you see Warden tell Newman, and then, like you talk about, he does this stagger backwards, and he's just gobsmacked. that he's been betrayed like this. And as you mentioned, it leads to the scene where he finds her in a bar and they stare at each other and he gets closer and closer. And then he just hauls off and decks her. And, you know, boy, talk about not something that would fly nowadays. And
I was super uncomfortable watching it, but it was also incredibly entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, and it's sort of funny because when he knocks her to the ground and she's got blood coming out of her mouth, and one of the guys, when there's a bunch of other bar patrons, of course, grab Newman and restrain him, and someone else leans over to her and says, "Are you all right?" And she says, "I'm fine." And then she says to the people trying to help her, "Leave him alone." And the people in the bar, I think in that moment, know, okay, there's a weird dynamic going on here that we don't really want to get involved in, and they just kind of leave her alone at that point because they're like, okay, clearly these two have a bit of a something going on that we're not involved in.
I acknowledge what you're saying and the motivations of them in leaving the situation alone after she asked them to, I guess somewhat understandable. It's still shocking that like they restrain him after he openly strikes this woman and she falls to the ground in public. It is still like shocking to me that like they temporarily restrain him, and you know, after a couple perfunctories, no, leave him alone. They're just kind of like, all right, back to business, guys.
Yeah, to go back to my drinks. Now, do you think? I mean, of course, I probably in real life, Frank Galvin would reveal all this and call for a mistrial. He wouldn't continue on. Is that? I would assume that's the way it really should have been done.
I would have called for a mistrial the moment the judge started monkeying around with the testimony. But yes, there were several intervals at which a mistrial would have not only been appropriate, but encouraged and ultimately would have done. Like, there's no way this would have gone forward after this series of events, particularly once you discover that Charlotte Rampling's on the take. It's like, there's no, I mean, it loses a little bit of credibility from, again, a legal procedural standpoint, but from a dramatic standpoint, it's like manna from heaven or up.
Right. So he ends up, Galvin finds this nurse, played by Lindsay Krause, who of course is Mrs. David Mamet, and finds her, and we find out that she was the nurse at the time. She actually was told by the patient that she had only eaten an hour earlier, and that was the problem. The doctors ignored that, and they didn't treat her accordingly with that information, and she comes to the trial as a surprise witness, and she reveals on the stand that they forced the nurse to change the record to 9 hours to cover their own asses. And in fact, she even has a copy of the original document, which says that it was 1 hour, not 9 hours, which completely changes the case. But James Mason's character uses some legal maneuvers to basically say, look, you know, you can't bring in this piece of paper when we have the original, because the original has more prominence over a copy. So that piece of evidence is stricken. And because she's only here to talk about this piece of evidence, we've already stricken the evidence. Her entire testimony is stricken.
And by the nature of her being a last minute rebuttal witness, that was, mainly relying on a piece of evidence that was stricken. Therefore, her whole testimony was to be stricken, and the judge, in fairly quick, shocking succession, threw out the evidence and then instructed the jury to ignore this heart-wrenching testimony that she had given about, basically having a conversation with one of the accused physicians where he basically orders her to doctor this document, indicating the amount of time before this patient had gone into surgery after she had eaten, threatening her with the loss of her job. So we would call it material testimony and evidence and a very, like I said, heart-wrenching rendition, retelling by her where she dissolves into tears, high theatrical value, high probative value, and the judge is like, nope, jury, gotta disregard that.
Now, I'm going to ask you if that's realistic, and what I mean is, I don't mean it, is it realistic, is that it happens, because I know it happens. I know that there's evidence that you have to say, that should not have been said, that shouldn't have been revealed, strike it. But is it realistic to tell a bunch of jurors, I know you just heard this thing, but you can't let that creep into your mind? How is that humanly possible?
100% it is, and it is 100% like, listen, and this is going to sound like very like foreign and alien, and I don't mean it to, but like this was incredibly, like to me, I've been in enough situations firsthand and, through the grapevine that like it is perfectly reasonable to instruct a jury to disregard certain things that have been heard. First, I mean, again, realistically, none of this would have ever gotten to this stage. There would have been plenty of notice about what was going to happen, so you don't have these last-minute theatrics. This is what the discovery process is for, even for last-minute rebuttal witnesses. You have to bring in paperwork, and you have to, like, request the court's permission to, like, have them in. People have to have notice of what's going to happen, so you don't have these last-minute theatrical hijinks. But in the event that, you know, a judge instructs a jury to disregard, you know, very vital, ostensibly vital information they just witnessed, I would have the full expectation that a jury would, because, you know, in a jury deliberating room, you are expected to throw that out. And as an attorney, I would expect that I would remove the human calculation from it like 100%, and I would expect them to deliberate having disregarded that evidence. And I know that sounds insane, but I'm telling you, yes, it's incredibly realistic to instruct a jury to do that and to expect them to. But there are safeguards built in to the system such that such highly prejudicial last-minute evidence would either not be allowed from the get-go, or the sides would have proper notice about them such that they would be able to prepare for it accordingly. You know what I mean?
Interesting. Okay. All right. That's good to know. But by the way, before we get to the final scene of this movie, we do need to mention, I guess you're familiar with the famous, soon-to-be-famous person that's a courtroom spectator in the final scenes of this movie?
Who are we talking about?
Bruce Willis.
What are you talking about? Seriously?
A young Bruce Willis with hair, with a lot of hair.
Well, now you're lying.
He is sitting in the front row of the auditorium, or whatever you would call it, that's directly behind the defense team. He's there. Young Bruce Willis. I mean, and apparently so was Tobin Bell, the guy that was in all the Saw movies. I don't know enough what Tobin Bell looks like to recognize him, but
rewatch that scene. Yeah, I have no idea.
I've seen this movie 100 times, and I knew Bruce Willis was in the courtroom, and I could never find him. And then we were watching it. Darlene Tracy and I were watching it again in anticipation of this episode, and she spotted him. She's like, "There he is!" And once you see him, you can't unsee him. That's clearly Bruce Willis.
So Bruce Willis.
There you go. So this was, you know, two legendary film figures sort of crossing paths at different points in their career.
And you know, as by way of anecdote, they would reunite 12 years later for a wonderful movie called Nobody's Fool, in which Newman earned his ninth Best Actor nomination.
You know what? That's funny. I completely forgot that Willis is in that movie. He's in that movie. That's a terrific movie.
It is.
So anyway, the judge says strike that testimony from your minds and give it no weight. And he flashes his eyebrows at them and stuff.
And Rob, can I ask, just to interrupt quickly? Can I ask? That's an aspect of that that you find? I mean, again, understanding that you're not a lawyer and you're not like knee deep in the legal system. That's an aspect of it that you're just like, how can you unsee that?
I just think that I think a lot of jurors would probably know that they can't audibly say, "I'm making my decision based on this testimony that I've been told not to strike." But internally, they would just go, he's guilty or not guilty, because deep down, they would just say, you know what I mean? Like,
I think they
would just hide it. They would just say, "Look, there's no way that I'm not believing that nurse. I can't say it out loud, but that's my decision."
No, I totally get it. I intuitively, you would think that. I'm just imagining, again, and this is a throwback to 12 Angry Men, I guess. I'm imagining this goody two-shoes juror or jury foreman who's just like, "Now, guys, we're going to talk about this, because remember, you have to explicitly forget that we saw that, and, you know, that goody two-shoes is going to, you know, follow procedure right down to the bone, and, you know, and end up convincing people to follow suit." But listen, there's probably a halfway reasonable answer between, you know, my cynicism and, you know, the way you're looking at it. But yeah, no, I totally get where you're coming from. I just want to clarify that was the unrealistic portion.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll be honest, I'll say this right on the air. If I am ever on a jury that has anything to do with convicting Donald Trump of anything, I'm going to completely lie and say I can be fair.
Yeah, if I was Donald Trump's attorney, and man, if wishing made it so, I would seek to exclude you in a second.
I'd put my hand on the Bible and go, "No, I'm totally fine. I have no preconceptions of this man whatsoever." And then the minute I get in the trap, I'm like, "What do you need me to do?" I mean, I would just lie. I just would. I'm sure that any good lawyer would see through that in a microsecond, but I'm going to admit that's just the way it would be.
And that is why jury selection is incredibly important, and why that brief scene where Frank was kind of at the beginning bumbling through his interrogatories of the prospective jurors was painful for me to watch, because it is vital. It is vital to, like, know your jury, to speak to your jury, to, like, understand the demographics of your jury, their race, their political affiliation, their professional and personal experience. Are they married? Are they divorced? I mean, again, in my context with this type of law, you know, a lot of cases, to the extent you take them to trial, and not a lot of cases go to trial, 95% of cases settle, and this case in this movie should have settled, like, but for the rare cases that actually go to trial, you spend a lot of time thinking about the demographics of your jury. It's just like, are we going to play to this, you know, lily white suburban, you know, are we going to take this rough criminal in front of this lily white suburban community of 12 people? You actually think about these things. It makes you incredibly cynical. But yeah, that's another interesting component of the whole process.
So the verdict comes back, and literally the titular verdict comes back. And,
yes.
You know, this is a movie that I think, unlike a lot of other movies, earns its happy ending, because the jury comes back and says, not only do we find in favor of the plaintiff, the foreman says, are we allowed to award an amount greater than what even they're asking for? And there's this great, I mean, for a film that has very few noticeable camera moves, Lumet's camera is pretty still the most of the movie. There's a nice push in during Newman's great final summation, which is, again, a marvelous piece of acting because it's all in one shot. It's really beautiful. But there's this sweeping camera shot where the camera is kind of up above Newman's table and then swings down and almost kind of like comes under the table a little and then rises up just as Newman realizes what he's hearing. And it's, again, it's a film that has very little music. There's no triumphant music. There's no da-da or anything like that. It's just in this moment of Newman just clenching his fist and going, like, yes, he got it. And it's, again, it's a movie that just earns that ending. So many movies, you know, throw in a happy ending at the very end because they have to have a happy ending. But this movie feels like it deserves it. You want to see Frank Galvin win so badly that when it happens, it's so rewarding.
Because we were on a journey. We crawled through the crap with him, and we saw him, like, at rock bottom. And we also saw the transformation of him into someone who was alert, someone with passion, someone who, like, went the extra mile, someone who was desperate at times, but also, like, was guided by, like, a very righteous North Star. Someone who was incredibly irresponsible throughout, but, like, always with the best intention. So you feel exhausted by the end of it, but it really did earn its happy ending. But can I tell you, like, as we get into the discussion of the last scene, my confession is, you know, when I first saw this movie, and again, I was fairly young, I thought that it was a really downbeat ending, because I thought when she was calling him, when Charlotte Rampling was calling him, because they come out of the courtroom and he sees her across the hall in the commons, and he walks away, and you see her calling him, and you see the phone ringing. When I was younger, I was like, what a devastatingly sad ending, because I thought he was drunk again. I thought what he was sipping out of that cup was not coffee, but booze, and I thought he was completely hammered, and he was not, like, answering the phone because he was just back to being Frank, and I think I just thought about this too much. Because it is a happy ending, and I'm very curious about what you thought of that last scene.
Well, that is amazing that you bring that up, because I have that in my notes. I almost think that you somehow saw my notes, Omar, because one of the things that I always remember about this movie is that Roger Ebert, I read a lot of Roger Ebert when I was a kid. He was really one of the people that got me into, like, film criticism.
And, as well, you should. His writing's amazing.
Yeah, analyzing movies more than just as entertainment, and he gave the verdict at the time 4 stars. He said it's just a great movie. But at the end, he describes the ending just as you describe it, where he says he always assumed that Paul Newman's character, because we see Charlotte Rampling, she's in a hotel, she's drunk, there's like 4 meals worth of room service, you know, half eaten, sitting on the bed, so clearly she's in this kind of dissolute state. She calls Frank. We cut to him, and he is drinking, and he's got a coffee cup, and he's drinking. And Roger Ebert said he thought that was Newman still drinking, and he said,
"Crazy! I had no idea." I mean,
yes.
I read Ebert all the time. I guess I never read that particular review of the verdict. Like, I had no idea. Okay, I thought I was being nuts in retrospect.
Nope. his take was, he says this movie shows you that even sometimes victory can taste just like defeat. And Sidney Lumet apparently read that review and was so bothered that Ebert was misreading the scene and explicitly wrote to Ebert and said,
No,
that's coffee in the coffee cup. That's why it's a coffee cup. Now, clearly he could have booze in a coffee cup, but they made it a coffee cup to underline the fact that Galvin isn't drinking anymore and Charlotte Rampling's character is. And that gives Galvin, like, he's now got a new lease on life that, yes, it's a sad ending because he doesn't answer the phone. He's not interested in being with Charlotte Rampling's character, but he's not drinking anymore. But, I mean, that's how much it bothered Sidney Lumet that he, like, reached out to Ebert to say, no, you're missing.
Well, listen, I mean, that it makes me feel better that you bring that up. And I would also say that, I mean, if great minds like myself and Roger Ebert, both, by the way, alums of the same university, could independently come to the same conclusion, then maybe there is a little more ambiguity to that scene on first glance than you would think. I mean, listen, in retrospect, I totally buy that it's a happy ending. I totally buy with, like, Newman's nonverbals and his facial expressions, he's clearly sober. But maybe there's, like, a 5% aspect to it, and maybe just because the rest of the movie was seen pointed, like, it seemed in a zigzag direction, maybe it is reasonable to conclude that it was a little bit more ambiguous than one would think.
Oh, I think so. I mean, maybe, like, they could have shown, like, the coffee pot in the background. Like, then you could have been like, okay, there's the coffee pot or something. But the fact that you just see the coffee cup, you're like, well, that really could be anything. It could be booze in his coffee cup. There's no rule that says it has to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, and so it ends on Galvin just letting the phone ring, and that's the end of the movie. And, I mean, it's just an extraordinary every actor here is at the top of his game. This movie went on to be nominated for 5 Oscars: picture, actor, director, supporting actor, and writing.
Can we talk about this for a second? Can we talk about that award season in this movie, please? Like,
yes, I want to mention it was nominated for 5 Oscars and won nothing.
Okay, yes, it won nothing. Now, I in addition to being a movie buff, I am also a movie fan. I am an Oscar buff. I care very much about the Oscars. I care very much about Oscar history. I care very much about Oscar trivia. I care very much about the weight of the Academy Awards on the legacy of the movies. But instances like this are why I should not, because this is a towering achievement. This movie is, like, one of the great films that came out of Hollywood in the last, like, 50 years. I don't think it's close. I think it is a late career, like, triumph for the director, an early career triumph for the writer, and a late career triumph for the lead actor. I think every actor is at the top of its game. And, like, that – and, again, I try not to be an Oscar scold, but there are just moments when it's just like, are you kidding me? Like, are you kidding me? Like, I think the 5 nominations is not enough, but the notion that they were completely shut out, and that, again, perfectly respectable movie won Gandhi, but I do not think Gandhi has stood the test of time as well as The Verdict. I think E.T. and Tootsie, and I can't remember what the 5th one, I'm assuming E.T. got nominated for Best Picture.
Yes, it did.
But I like E.T. and Tootsie very much. This was one of those injustices that make the Oscars lose credibility. Lumet and Newman went, like Lumet went to his grave without ever winning a competitive Academy Award. And it is, beyond being a head scratcher, it is a crime scene that, like, that never happened. Like, this would have been, Rob, there are those moments where actors and filmmakers are given what are essentially considered, like, makeup Oscars late in their careers. Like, you know, you got Denzel Washington for Training Day, you got Al Pacino for Scent of a Woman, a lot of people say Scorsese with The Departed. This would have been a wonderful opportunity to honor Lumet and Newman when they are at their peak, operating, like, in singular form. And especially when you give the weight of all the work that Lumet had done up to this point, and you add it to the idea that this would have been a meritorious win. Same thing with Newman. He had been nominated, like, 6 or 7 times before this point, and that he still went home empty-handed. I get that Ben Kingsley was good in Gandhi, but it is stunning to me. It has never sat well with me that, like, 2 people who are at, like probably remembered at or near the top of their respective fields were not honored for this movie. It's kind of a punch in the stomach.
I would not wanted to have to pick among this group of actors for best actor, because that year, as you mentioned, it was Ben Kingsley for Gandhi, Newman for The Verdict, Dustin Hoffman for Tootsie, Jack Lemmon for Missing, and Peter O'Toole for My Favorite Year.
Oh, God, I forgot about Peter O'Toole. Oh, God. I would not want to have been one of
them. Yeah, I mean, the only film there that I haven't seen is Missing, and I'm always willing to give Jack Lemmon a nomination because he's Jack Lemmon. Jack Lemmon's always really, very good. But, I mean, even if you exclude him, Kingsley.
And I'm fine excluding him because he had won a couple times before.
Right. Yeah, but Kingsley, Newman, Hoffman, and O'Toole that year are all really amazing performances. I don't know how you compare them. How do you compare the performance Dustin Hoffman gives in Tootsie, which is brilliant, and he carries the movie. I mean, it's one of the great comedies ever made, against Paul Newman in The Verdict versus Ben Kingsley as Gandhi. I mean, I don't know. These are apples and oranges and bananas you're comparing. But I agree. It's Gandhi is the kind of movie I haven't seen it in a long time. I liked it when I saw it a bunch of years ago.
There's a reason that you're not firing it up on the DVD or on streaming to watch it again and again.
It's, right. It's the kind of movie the Oscars love giving Oscars to, because it's that big sweeping epic, and they like that kind of movie. And The Verdict is small and internal. Lumet pretty much stays away from any of the typical iconography of trial movies. There's no shots of this blind of the Statue of Justice. There's no shots of the giant pillars. He stays all that. It's mostly inside rooms. It's inside small spaces, and that I think it maybe gives the film an unfortunate feeling of like smallness, that it's a smaller story, and it's not. But it's he chooses to shoot it in a different way than what you would see
an inherent bias. I mean, this is just me getting Oscar political, but like there is a little bit of an inherent bias that they built in against kind of the New York filmmakers. Like it was a scandal that Scorsese didn't win until 2006. That Spike Lee has never been nominated until hopefully this coming year for Black Klansman. You know that. Aside from Woody Allen, they just aren't biting at that kind of thing. And this was a small interior movie that was all about the performances. You're right. By design, it was going to be overlooked against the type of movies that Hollywood traditionally likes. And you know, to Newman and Lumet's credit, they probably would not care. They don't care that much. It's fine. The world will continue to rotate on its axis. But, you know, I just think this was just another example of Lumet, for example, just not getting his due. And you know, he said it himself, like, from the mid-70s onward. He's like, the moment that, like, Network lost to, like, goddamn Rocky. A movie I love, by the way, but, like, no way should it have beaten The Network or All the President's Men or Taxi Driver. Like, he's just like, yeah, I knew I wasn't going to win. And that's fine. And Newman eventually got his Oscar for Scorsese's The Color of Money, which he was very good at, and it's fine. It's just that this is the kind of movie that needs to be celebrated. This is a movie that, like, has a propulsive narrative force, that is a masterful character study, that, you know, uses the courtroom, you know, sort of as a metaphor for this guy's journey. There is never a moment where I'm looking at my watch or looking at my phone now when I'm absorbed. I was telling you, Rob, before we started recording that, like, I was angry at you while I was watching this kind of thing on peak time because, you know, I like to prepare for our podcast, and so I like to diligently take notes so I sound like a little bit less of a moron than I usually sound like. But I had to constantly pause this movie to make observations because this is a movie that demands observations on, like, the smallest moments. And it involved me pausing the movie a lot when all I really wanted to do once I was 2 minutes in, once that iconic sweeping Godfather filmography feed dissolved into the pinball in the first 10 seconds, all I wanted to do was, like, stop writing and watch this masterpiece. And, like, Slave Driver Rob, like, wouldn't let me. You know what I mean? And, like, these are the kind of movies that need to be celebrated and remembered. And you know, to me, Newman, this is Newman at the top of his game. He is, like, to me, the iconic actor since, like, 1950. And, like, we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of his death. And Rob has the misfortune of following me on Twitter, where I will have some things to say on the 25th of this month. Because, like, I just think he was never given his due because of the way he looked, because of the assumptions we made about him, about his versatility and his chameleon-like ability to kind of disappear into roles, and the fact that he embodies the kind of, in his performances and in his life, the kind of masculinity that I think is sorely missing, just kind of a benevolent, you know, loving masculinity. And I think his decision to take this movie, which just goes against type and our assumptions about him as a man and an actor in so many ways, was just very fitting to the kind of performer he was.
I agree. I love that, to the final detail of this movie. I love that Lumet takes the time to let Newman put the egg in his beer to do it with the hangover, which I couldn't help but think was a nod to Cool Hand Luke, which was just, you know, like this was that was Newman in, at his absolute most gorgeous prime, and about a guy fighting the system and sort of him at his best. And now here he's using the eggs again, but in a more depressing manner and a kind it's of like stave off his hangover. So it's just amazing. And yeah, Lumet, I mean, good Lord. I mean, these were the films Lumet made in a 10-year period. This is starting in 73. This is just starting in 73, skipping all the other movies he did before that. This is from 73 on. Serpico, Love and Molly, Murder on the Orient Express, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, Equus, The Wiz, Just Tell Me What You Want, Prince of the City. Prince of the City, Death Trap, and The Verdict. That was his 10-year run. That's unbelievable.
It's staggering. He was prolific in the amount of movies he made and the quality of the movies he made and the kind of actors who were attracted to him. And you know, like I had said at the beginning of this recording, I would not have known who Sidney Lumet was were it not for an honorary Oscar that was given to him in like 2005, and Al Pacino was his presenter. And like this to me is another argument for why, like, you know, we watch these 3-hour Oscar telecasts and they're cutting away, they're chopping out these honorary Oscars where, you know, young people who care about movies can learn about, you know, learn about film history. And like I never would have gotten kind of hip to the Sidney Lumet's movies were it not for that. And I think it's a real shame that, you know, sort of this part of Hollywood history is being eaten away, you know, in the interest of just a few extra dollars. And I would encourage all of the listeners out there. I mean, Rob just named, you know, this iconic 10-year run that he was had. I would also point you guys to movies that he made post-Verdict, because he didn't stop making movies until he was like in his early to mid 80s. So I would put in a plug not just for The Verdict in the earlier movies, but I would say Running on Empty from 1988. He did a wonderful movie with Vin Diesel called Find Me Guilty in 2006, and his last movie Before the Devil Knows You're Dead with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke, and
great movie.
That was his last movie. It was 2007. Go out and see it. Lumet is like, he is a master craftsman, and he knows how to get the best performances out of actors. And, you know, I guess the consolation we can take, even if the wider audience isn't as familiar with him as, like, Spielberg or whatever, people who knew about movies and actors who knew good filmmaking were drawn to him, like a moth to a flame. And so we're very lucky to have such a prolific filmmaker, have such an extensive library that we can have access to. And this is a towering movie for them.
Yeah, it's a pretty standard thing of when you get really successful in Hollywood and your films kind of start losing their edge a little, because you're wealthy at that point, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You've hit the lottery of life, and your films get just less vital because you yourself are very comfortable. You're mega rich and you're living this very Tony lifestyle.
Yeah.
But Before the Devil Knows You're Dead that movie crackles with energy, and you just cannot believe that a guy in his early 80s directed it. That's just how much it's vital and alive is really startling. He went out on a
film historian. He wrote books on movies. I believe I'm going to say he taught at NYU or one of the New York schools. Like, this was someone who really cared about movies. And you know, it's our loss that we don't have his perspective right now with what's going on. He's a great voice that's missed. And you know, I take comfort in the fact that like actors who knew the deal loved Sidney Lumet. Like Al Pacino is one of his biggest champions. And you know, other filmmakers, the Spike Lees, the Scorseses, and younger filmmakers too, like, constantly nod to him and the influence he has. And at the end of the day, that's all you can ask for.
Yeah, it's an amazing movie. And even though we've gone through all the plot details and we've revealed the ending, if you have not seen The Verdict, go see it. It's available on iTunes. It's on DVD. It's on Blu-ray. It is a wonderful movie. It's just a great adult drama that they don't make anymore because, you know, it's either...
Yeah, what studio is going to make this movie at that,
no,
you know, the commensurate budget, you know?
Yeah, it's either you know, $900,000 Purge movies or the Avengers Infinity War. There's nobody makes movies in between anymore. These adult dramas about adult people doing adult things. So again, even if you haven't seen this movie and we've sort of spoiled it, doesn't matter. Go see it. It is just a marvelous exercise. And so this was a movie that I saw on cable when I was a young person, like I was probably like 12 or 13, and I hooked into it even at that age, even though it was about lots of things I didn't fully understand or appreciate. And it means a lot to me. It's one of my all-time favorite movies, and I really wanted to make sure that when I covered it on the show that I did it right. And so that's why I invited Omar on, because Omar has been one of my favorite guests, and I knew we would do a great job. And so, Omar, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this movie. It was terrific.
No, this has been a real pleasure, and I was really delighted to, you know, not only get a chance to talk about it, but to learn that, you know, this is a movie that you hold highly, hold in high esteem. And I just, I would echo Rob's encouragement, despite the fact that we've spoiled everything, to go and see it. It's a movie that stands up, and you can't really say that about that many movies, you know, that from that era, in terms of like withstanding like the scrutiny of the modern age. And I think this is a movie that's kind of unimpeachable. So I'm really delighted that you invited me to talk about it. I was worried at first that maybe you thought like, well, you're a lawyer, you have some perspective, but I just love the fact that you know, are talking to me as a fellow fan of the movie and as a Sidney Lumet and Paul Newman fan. And yeah, it's always fun to get a chance to speak with you. And, you know, I'm really happy about what you're doing.
Yeah, I can't wait. We're going to wind back. Omar's going to be back on the show at some point, and we're going to talk about 12 Angry Men. We got to wind back and talk about another masterpiece from Sidney Lumet.
And again, he was barely 30 when he made it. What were you doing when you were 30? What was I doing?
Yeah.
A movie like that.
It's unbelievable. So anyway, we're not going to wrap up the show just now. In fact, we're going to play a couple of podcast promos. And then when you come back, I'm going to have a special announcement. So stay tuned.
Hey there. Welcome to the Mirror Factory. I'm the foreman, Max Romero. So let me tell you a little bit about what we do here. The Mirror Factory is a podcast where we talk about your favorite passages from novels, novellas, and short stories. Each episode features a different guest, who will tell us a little about the book their passage is from and why it means so much to them. Then that guest will give us a special reading of their favorite passage for our listeners. If you think you'd like to be a guest on the Mirror Factory, drop us a line at Factory Mirror on Twitter, The Mirror Factory on Facebook, or at mirrorfactorypodcast@gmail.com. The Mirror Factory is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Oop, time to get back to work. Until next time, read a book.
Back through the Fire and Water Network.
Come
back with the Supermates.
I said, come back.
Back to
the House of Frankenstein.
The Supermates present four blood-curdling films with an all-star cast.
Lon Chaney Jr.
I know you'll think I'm crazy, but in a half an hour the moon will rise and I'll turn into a wolf.
Gary Busey.
I'm a little too old to be playing the Hardy Boys Meet Reverend Werewolf.
Christina Ricci.
I'd love to have a tame one, but I wouldn't have the heart to cage him.
Corey Haim.
I want you to turn this into a silver bullet.
Bela Lugosi.
You should be careful. A person can get killed that way.
Johnny Depp.
No, you must believe me. It was a horseman, a dead one. Headless.
Peter Cushing.
Have you heard of the cult of the undead?
Bud Abbott and Lou Costello.
Do you know what could happen if I meet Dracula in the woods?
I'll bite.
Oh, no, you gotta stand in line.
Plus four monstrous battles with your favorite comic book heroes.
I sense you're trying to resist this evil, Batman. Open your mind so I can help you.
Destroy me, Jean.
Booster Gold, Vampire Slayer!
This September and October, come back to the Fire and Water Network and the home of horror and heroes.
I believe you're in the House of Dracula right now.
No, wrong address. Come back to the House of Frankenstein.
Bat?
Yes, Master.
He thinks I'm Dracula.
And we're back. Thanks, everybody, for sticking with the show. The special announcement that I need to make is, much like I did after episode 100 of the show, now that we're up to episode 150, I'm going to put the Film and Water podcast on a temporary hiatus. And I probably should even use the word break, because hiatus even sounds probably a little longer than I mean it to be. But I'm not exactly sure how long the break's going to be. It won't be for terribly long, but I do want to take a little bit of time off for a couple different reasons. One is there are some things about the show that I want to try and improve. Unlike my other solo shows that I do, Pod Dylan and Mountain Comics and Treasury Cast, and MASHcast. No, those are all shows that in one way or the other sort of I can do in my sleep. The Pod Dylans and the MASHcast, I mean, I know that content backwards and forwards. So there's really no – there's not a lot of research I need to do for any of those episodes. And Treasury Cast is a little bit of a different thing there too. But with the Film and Water podcast, because I let the guests tend to guide the films that I want to talk about at least some of the time, I have to do kind of a lot of research because I really want to make sure that – I do justice to the movies in question. And sometimes I find myself kind of rushing through things to kind of get the episodes out in time. And I realize that's, you know, I'm not doing a service to the movie. I'm not doing the service to my guests. And I'm not doing service to you because there are, you know, again, unlike Pod Dylan or MASHcast or Treasury Cast, there are a billion other movie podcasts out there. There's a billion others that you could be listening to, and I appreciate the fact that anyone listens to this show because, again, there is so much competition out there. So I want to do the best show I possibly can, and I have found myself at times, again, just kind of like rushing through, taking my notes, or worse yet, like not watching other movies I want to watch just for pleasure because I feel like, oh, I should be watching this other thing for Film and Water, and that's kind of like the tail wagging the dog. I really should be able to watch movies for my own entertainment and not worry about that I'm taking time away from the show or things like that. So I have a couple things in mind that I want to try and work on. I think I want to do some more theme-related shows and sort of not necessarily talking about one movie, but maybe picking a topic and talking about several movies that are fit around that topic. And that's all stuff that I need to sort of work out in my head. So I'm just going to give myself a little time off to kind of regroup, recharge my batteries, and then when I come back, I'll be able to kind of hopefully do the show exactly the way I hope to do it, and it comes out exactly the way I hope to do it. In the meantime, MASHcast, which of course has been in this show's quote-unquote time slot, 2 weeks out of every month, is going to go up to 3 weeks, and then I'm going to take 1 week off. I'm actually going to have a week off. I don't know what I'm going to do with all that extra time, but I am actually going to take a week off. The Turn It Off with Tracy episodes, they will keep going because it's sort of a separate thing. And I will have at least one special episode of the Film and Water podcast coming during the hiatus. There's a movie coming out that I absolutely cannot ignore because I've been so excited for its release. So I'm going to do a special episode about that when it comes out. Expect that sometime in November. But again, for a little while at least, I'm going to put the show on a break so I can come back and make the show hopefully even better. In the meantime, I do want to thank everybody that has taken the time to come on my show and talk with me about movies. I really appreciate it. I mean, the show is really about the guests, not so much me, because it's like that's the reason why I don't do solo shows for the most part. I want to have a guest on to talk back and forth about movies. That's the enjoyment of it. So I need to thank my guests that have been on the show, starting with episode 101, and that's David Ace Gutierrez, Derek William Crabb, Ryan Daly, Scott X, Zaki Hassan, Brian Hall, Michael Cronenberg, Kevin Lauderdale, Amanda Reyes, Ryan S. Murphy, April Snelling, Sarah Jane, Josh Karp, Corey Drew, Chuck Coletta, Michael Lane, Dr. Ange, Siskoid, Crystal Beth, Chris Cummins, Max Romero, The Irredeemable Shag, Paul Spataro, Martin Gray, Nicholas Prom, Tim Wallace, Harper W. Harris, Kim Cavill, Sean Myers, Laura Menk, Tom Panarese, Terry Mahoney, my dad, Chris Franklin, Sean Ross, Luke Dobb, Gotham Sheeran, and of course, Omar Uden. Again, I thank every one of you guys for coming on the show. It's been really great talking with you all about movies and stuff. And I love movies so much, and I want to do them justice. And so I feel like if I can take a little time off and make sure that when it comes back is the best it can be, that'll be the best tribute possible to the films in question. So, like I said, so the hiatus is not going to be real long. I think the last one, the one between 100 and 101, I think I planned it to be like 3 months, and then it came back a month early just because I couldn't wait to get back on that horse. So that might be the same thing that happens here. So, like I said, in the meantime, there will still be episodes of Turn It Off with Tracy. There will be at least one special episode of the show coming out. And, of course, we'll be covering other movies on other shows. Obviously, yeah, Shag and I will be talking about the Aquaman movie, probably on Fire and Water, so there's going to be that too. But again, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks everybody for commenting. Thanks everybody for who retweets and likes the show on Facebook. I really do appreciate it. And like I said, there's a million other movie podcasts out there. And so anytime anyone listens to my show, I deeply, deeply appreciate it. So again, thanks everybody, and we will see you shortly. And until then, that's a wrap.
What do you do if you don't have a witness?
He was there with us.
That's right.
I think we tried that, Francis. Case is over. You know, you broke the first rule I ever taught you in law school. You never ask a question unless you have the answer to it. Even your own expert witness said there was no negligence. It's over, period. There'll be other cases.
There are no other cases. This is the case. There are no other cases. This is the case. There are no other cases. This is the case. No other cases. This is the case.